The Yemeni army says it's carried out large-scale drone attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia against multiple targets, including Aramco oil facilities. U.S. issues new threats against Iran, with its Secretary of Defense saying Washington has other options if the upcoming Vienna talks over the 2015 nuclear deal fail. And Sudanese call for mass anti-coup protests on Sunday as the number of people killed since last month's military takeover has risen to at least 40. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you joining us. First story takes us to the situation in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, where the Yemeni army has announced a large-scale military operation deep into Saudi territory in response to the kingdom's escalating attacks against the impoverished country. The Yemeni army spokesman says 14 drones were used in the retaliatory attack against targets across Saudi Arabia. Yahya Saadi said the King Khalid base was struck in Riyadh, while King Abdullah International Airport and Aramco oil facilities were targeted in Jeddah. He added that military targets were also hit in the Kingdom Zapa, Jazan, and Nasran regions. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition said it has carried out a major offensive in Yemen, targeting 13 areas in Sana'a, Saada, and Marib. Saudi Arabia has recently ramped up its war on Yemen, which it launched back in March of 2015 to reinstate a regime there. Tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions more displaced since that time. Next, hashtag trending brings you social media reactions to the systemic harassment of Palestinians at the hands of the Zionist regime.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Today, in this edition, we'll explore a familiar topic, a recurring topic, the issue of Palestine, and specifically, the plight of the residents of this historical land. Stick around. We have highlighted the crimes being committed against Palestinians on numerous occasions on the show, and one such crime is the practice of demolishing Palestinian homes to make more room for illegal settlements there. And this is the go-to Israeli policy to encroach on more and more Palestinian territories and, in essence, expand its territories. Several homes have already been razed to the ground in the occupied East Al-Quds neighborhood of Silwan as part of a grander scheme to Judaize the whole neighborhood. Now, let's start with the first comment on Twitter by Anwar. It reads, "The threat of forced displacement threatens about 7,500 individuals living in six neighborhoods in Silwan. These are threatened with demolishing their homes under the pretext of building without a permit or evacuating them for the benefit of settlement associations. Hashtag save Silwan." Arab organization tweeted this, "Israeli decision to demolish 84 properties in Silwan, home to 600 Palestinians. Hashtag save Silwan." DWI for Palestine tweeted, "The outbreak of confrontation in the city of Silwan in Jerusalem Al-Quds between the Zionist forces and the Palestinian youth." Well, such encounters have always been on the card. I mean, what else did you expect to happen? For the Palestinians to just resign to their ill fates and say nothing? Yeah, I don't think so. But this fight is being fought on an unfair battleground. Stones against lethal bullets, fireworks against artillery rounds. Anyways, moving on to the next tweet by Daily Muslim. It reads, "Three Palestinian youths were injured by murderous and illegal Israeli settlers who stormed the Ras Al Amud area, Silwan district in East Jerusalem, that is Al-Quds, under the protection of the Zionist police." Palestine wrote, "Burkan family continues demolishing their house in Ras Al Amud neighborhood in Silwan. After they were forced to demolish it, Zionist occupation demanded that they remove the rubble. Hashtag Zionist terrorism." Chris Hutchinson wrote, "Confrontations erupted between IOF and Palestinians in the town of Silwan in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, and the occupation forces fired sound bombs." The Palestinians are used to decades of aggression and harassment, but of course, that doesn't mean that they have lost their will to fight. No, sir. The Gaza-based Hamas is one of these popular entities that have been fighting for the rights of the Palestinians, and they have naturally paid the price for it heavily. The United Kingdom has recently joined the list of countries that have labeled them as a terrorist organization. Let's read some more comments on this. The first tweet comes from Hossein Amir Abdullahian, Iran's foreign minister. He said, "We condemn the UK's decision to declare the popular resistance movement of Hamas a terrorist organization. Rights of Palestinians cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. The only political solution for Palestine lies in holding a referendum among all indigenous residents." Our last couple of comments on Press TV's website. The first one is by Solution. It reads, "When that hour reaches, the UK and its allies will be defeated and Palestine will be liberated." The final comment comes from Ed USA. It reads, "The UK invented the word terrorist to refer to themselves. The so-called tiny island called the UK went and still going around the world and terrorized the defenseless so they can steal the natural resources of those lands. Who cares what these subhumans think?" All right, that's going to be it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Let's get back to the studio. But until next time, take care. Bye-bye.
Well, the United States has issued new threats against Iran. Its Secretary of Defense, that's Washington, has other options up its sleeves if the upcoming Vienna talks over the 2015 nuclear deal fail.
And we remain committed to a diplomatic outcome of the nuclear issue. But if Iran isn't willing to engage seriously, then we will look at all the options necessary to keep the United States secure.
Austin, now visiting Bahrain on a regional tour, stops short of explaining what those options could be. He says lingering differences can be resolved quickly if Iran comes back to the talks in Vienna with constructive positions. Iran has time and again blamed the U.S. for the current situation surrounding the nuclear deal. Tehran says Washington was the party that threw the multilateral pact into disarray with its unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Tehran has stressed that new discussions set to begin on November the 29th will only focus on the removal of all U.S. sanctions. Political commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh says the Pentagon chief's remarks show that Washington is seeking to continue the same approach of pressure and threats against Tehran, which has always ended in failure.
Separately speaking about the threat, the threats are no more credible when it comes or when they come from the United States. After the Global Hawk was shut down a couple of years ago, followed by the capture of the British ship and many other similar confrontations with the U.S. escorted ships that have been trying to loot Iranian oil in one way or another, and in the complete victory and by the Iranian IRGC Navy in these confrontations. And also after the missile raid on Ain al-Assad, which received no response from the United States. And it's much regretful that that they mean to continue their past behavior as if they have not realized that the government in Tehran has changed and this formula doesn't work towards the Iranian revolutionary government. And Tehran has learned the lesson pretty well. The Iranians have learned what to do with the Americans. It shows that the Americans are not serious and are not honest in their talks with Iran or in their indirect talks with Iran through the Europeans. It shows that they mean to continue to stonewall the talks in Vienna, unfortunately.
Anti-coup activists in Sudan have called for mass protests on Sunday amid growing anger at last month's military takeover of the African country. Sudan has witnessed a number of protests over the past several weeks to demand the return of a civilian government. This is the latest protest call despite deadly crackdown on people taken to the streets in major cities, including the capital Khartoum. Now, the country was thrust into chaos after top general Abdel Fattah al-Burhan ousted the transitional government on October the 25th and detained civilian leaders, including the prime minister. At least 40 anti-coup protesters have been killed since then. The military takeover has received widespread condemnations, including from the African Union. The Continental Bloc has also denounced the deadly crackdowns on pro-democracy protesters in Sudan. Well, Africa is turning into a new geopolitical battlefield between the U.S. on one side and China and Russia on the other. Washington is considering strengthening its military foothold on the continent to counter what it sees as the growing influence of its strategic rivals. But that has raised concerns considering America's track record in countries housing its military bases.
The competition between the U.S. and its eastern rivals, namely Russia and China, is entering new domains. Washington is set to strengthen its military grip in Africa, a move that's meant to counter Moscow and Beijing's growing influence on the continent. The issue is proposed in a sweeping defense bill that will be debated in Congress as soon as Thursday. If passed, the National Defense Authorization Act will be the first security initiative openly authorized by Congress since the Cold War to funnel military aid to African forces to counter Beijing and Moscow. The proposal lays the new groundwork for a long-term bid to expand U.S. military influence in Africa.
They don't care about development. They may say they want to see this and that, but all their work is on implementing their democracy and their conception of human rights on African nations and some military support. And rather than seeing the enemy as poverty in Africa, they see the enemy as Russia and China. Very stupid, very foolish, but unfortunately, that's the way United States leaders are thinking right now.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the U.S. But that's a cause for concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in East and West Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of U.S. bases. At least seven coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported.
The Senate's 2022 National Defense Authorization Act empowers the Pentagon to establish a strategic competition initiative for the U.S. Africa Command. If the bill passes, the U.S. will be able to send military aid to African forces to counter Beijing and Moscow, and that means expanded U.S. military influence in the world's second largest continent.
The United States' increased foothold in Africa has raised concerns, as the country hasn't had a good track record, even when it comes to delivering on its stated claim of fighting terrorism. Take Somalia, for example, where the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes against al-Shabaab terrorists for a decade. Despite the U.S. attacks, al-Shabaab has proven resilient and is still able to carry out high-profile attacks in the country and neighboring states such as Kenya. In addition, rights groups have long accused AFRICOM of shrouding its operations in secrecy and denying accountability for civilians killed in its airstrikes. The U.S. has failed to provide an accurate tally of the equipment and resources it has sent to U.S. Africa Command partner nations in its most recent audit. That has raised concerns that the equipment might have fallen into the wrong hands. The U.S. military clearly has accountability issues in Africa. The question is, why isn't Washington taking any initiative to improve the economies on the African continent to compete with China and Russia that are already working on several projects there?
In crude terms, either you have your foot on the other guy's throat or he has it on yours. And therefore, rather than seeing the world, the potential for expanding and developing the nations of the world, this Western geopolitical oligarchy says, no, we have to always remain on top. And everything they look at in the world is judged from this diseased geopolitical doctrine, which the British developed several 100 years ago.
What the U.S. needs to keep in mind when making decisions about investing militarily in Africa are the lessons from the outcome of its 20-year-long war in Afghanistan, as all the American lives lost and all the funds spent there turn out to be for nothing.
Chile will hold general elections on Sunday to choose the country's next president, lawmakers, and regional council members. Nearly 15 million people are eligible to cast their ballots. Seven candidates are vying for the presidency, with recent opinion polls showing two front runners. One is Gabriel Boric, a congressman who represents the left-wing coalition and was a leader of the student movement. Another main contender is Jose Antonio Kast from the far-right Christian Social Front Coalition. He is a lawyer and former congressman. A runoff will be held on December the 9th if none of the candidates obtains an outright majority. Voters will also elect all 155 members of the lower house of Congress, 27 of the 50 senators, and regional council representatives. We're going to switch to Germany. A new German government is taking shape with the incoming chancellor, Olaf Scholz, promising an equal number of women and men in his cabinet. A coalition of center-left social democrats, the Greens, and fiscally conservative Free Democrats is holding talks on selecting new cabinet members. Coalition officials say an agreement on portfolio distribution is likely to be reached in the coming week. Scholz is set to nominate three women from his own party for cabinet posts, including incumbent Environment Minister Simonja Schultz to run the economy ministry. Well, the incumbent labor minister is also set to keep his job due to his strong performance during the pandemic. Social Democrats narrowly won the federal election in September by beating Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservatives. Now, the coronavirus pandemic is surging through Europe, with the least vaccinated countries being at the center of the new wave of the disease. The spike has prompted new restrictions in a number of European countries. Austria is set to enter a 10-day national lockdown on Monday, becoming the first European country to impose such tough restrictions this fall. Authorities say the lockdown could be extended for another 10 days if necessary. Now, the government also plans to make vaccinations mandatory from February of next year. Thousands of Austrians have taken to the streets of the capital to voice their opposition to the government's new measures. Now, some two-thirds of Austria's population is fully vaccinated against COVID-19, one of the lowest rates in the EU. Elsewhere, the Netherlands is also struggling with the new surge in cases. The government has imposed new restrictions, including a health pass requirement to access indoor venues. Now, the measures have angered the people there. On Saturday, hundreds gathered in the capital, Amsterdam, and in the city of Breda to protest the recent curbs. That a day after similar protests in the city of Rotterdam turned violent after police fired warning shots and water cannons at protesters. Two people were injured and over 50 arrested. Several other European countries, including Germany, are also witnessing a surge in cases and deaths. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying with us.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Khomeini explains, unless a person fully acquaints himself with the knowledge of the Sharia laws and follows them faithfully, the higher value of morality cannot be attained by him. After attaining this stage, the truth unveiled for him and enlightenment bestowed upon his heart, a person would act with greater observance of the manifest forms of religion. This falsifies the claims of pseudo-spiritualists who say that the inner perfection can only be acquired by relinquishing outer accomplishments, or that after acquiring inner excellences, necessity of observing outward form does not remain obligatory. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, he has PhD on Islamic science.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We are with another golden saying of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini has said that you rose up for Islam and Islam is your support. And he who receives support from the Quran and Islam is surely victorious. I just remembered of one of the narrations by the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, where the Prophet has said that man kana lillah kana Allahu lahu, whoever is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah is for him. It means that if you live for Allah, if you work for Allah, if your lifestyle and all the actions that you perform, if you are for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and you do everything in order to please Allah Almighty, then kana Allahu lahu, then Allah is for that person, for such a person. Imam Khomeini is referring to something similar to this, and he says that if you rose up for Islam, then Islam is your support, and he who receives support from the Quran and Islam is surely victorious. Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala never leaves a person without granting him what he wants. If he is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if he gives a favor to the religion, to the Quran, Allah gives him the best favor and reward.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala
Have the verse of the Quran, Hal jaza'ul ihsan illa al-ihsan. Hal jaza'ul ihsan is the reward of favor, something except the favor itself. Yes, surely the reward of a favor is another favor by the person whom we have given the favor. Therefore, we need to work on the Islam, we need to search for the Islam, we need to propagate Islam. And if we are with the Islam, if we rose up for Islam, Islam will help us. It is the Islam that gives us the honor. And it is the Quran. Basically, when we are talking about the Islam, we are talking about the Quran. That if you live for Quran, if you live according to the Quran, then on the day of judgment, it is the Quran that will do the shafa'ah. And it is the Quran that helps us, because the guidance is in the Quran, and we need to get that guidance from the Quran. So if we follow the footsteps of Quran, we will be victorious, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
South African Development Community dedicated October the 25th as Anti-Sanctions Day in solidarity with Zimbabwe. It faces illegal and unilateral sanctions imposed by Western countries led by the United States. Now, to mark this day this year, Zimbabwe's president addressed the nation and started by explaining the background of the sanctions.
It is now two decades since our great country was slapped with unilateral, illegal, unjustified, and unfair sanctions following our decision to repossess our land grabbed from us by the minority white settler colonialists.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program which gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on US-led sanctions on Zimbabwe and how they are impacting negatively on ordinary people. In the second part of our program, we shall see how mostly American chocolate companies are involved in perpetuating child labor and slavery in West African cocoa plantations.
US-led sanctions hurting Zimbabweans. The illegitimate sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe by the United States and some other Western countries have lasted for two decades. The sanctions were imposed after Zimbabwe started a land reform program which saw indigenous people repossessing land that was occupied by European settlers during the colonial rule. The ensuing unilateral sanctions have gravely affected Zimbabwe's capability to develop and improve people's livelihood. A Zimbabwean protesting the illegal sanctions speaks on how innocent people are suffering.
Although they are said to be targeting a few, they are hitting the majority. So sanctions should go. We have suffered enough. The whole region is supporting us on our side because sanctions are hitting the poor majority of this nation.
Alina Dohan, a United Nations Special Envoy, has called on the United States and other Western countries to lift their sanctions on Zimbabwe. She says the restrictive measures are making ordinary people suffer. She made the call after her 10-day fact-finding mission in Zimbabwe and added that sanctions violate human rights obligations.
I'm concerned that existing unilateral targeted sanctions as a punitive action violate, at the very least, obligations arising from universal and regional human rights instruments, many of which have a peremptory character. In particular, procedural guarantees and presumption of innocence, with a view that the grounds for their introductions do not constitute, for the most part, international crimes or comply with the grounds for universal criminal jurisdiction.
Now, for more on how the US-led sanctions are hurting ordinary Zimbabweans, we contacted Alina Dohan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures. Thanks a lot for your time, madam.
It's a pleasure.
Now, you visited Zimbabwe last October to assess the impact of sanctions. Can you tell us your first-hand experience of how the US-led sanctions are hurting ordinary Zimbabweans?
First of all, it's necessary to make the point that that's not only the United States which is imposing sanctions against Zimbabwe. There are a number of other countries. In particular, there are sanctions in force implemented by Canada and Australia. And the United Kingdom. At the same time, the European Union and Switzerland, for example, have minimized the list of active cases and up to zero right now. I have to admit that today, unfortunately, the number of Zimbabwean interlocutors, both public and private, including private individuals, are reporting that their bank accounts are being closed all around the world. They have been requested to withdraw their money. They refer to the problem of doing direct bank transfers, so the direct trade is not possible. Therefore, they have to use different sorts of mediators that make the transactions as well as makes any business longer and more complicated and more costly at the very end. And as a result, Zimbabwe is facing serious problems in the economic sector. It faces serious problems as concerns the delivery of the essential infrastructure equipment and spare parts, as well as a number of medicine and other essential goods. Therefore, the multiple problems as for the access to clean water have been reported. Zimbabwe is facing multiple incidents of cholera and problems as concerns the treatment of COVID-19 cases because of the absence of running water in the majority of places. It faces some impediments in function of other elements of critical infrastructure as well.
The US-led unilateral sanctions on Zimbabwe were reportedly meant to target individuals and selected organizations, but that has not been the case. Overcompliance with sanctions has increased the suffering of ordinary people who are now bearing the brunt of the sanctions. A Zimbabwean activist believes her country is unfairly targeted by Western countries over alleged human rights abuses.
The rule of law can never be defined in precise terms anywhere in the world. So some of these issues, they talk of human rights abuses. People are killed every day in USA. A lot is happening in all those countries that sanctioned us, but they are not under sanctions. So what's so special about Zimbabwe?
Now, the list of designated individuals and companies is very limited, yet it appears overcompliance with these unilateral sanctions is hurting ordinary Zimbabweans. Can you elaborate on that, please?
This impact is exacerbated enormously by the practice of overcompliance from the side of banking system and from the side of the third country companies. I have been repeatedly reported about the multiple cases when the banks are deciding to close their bank accounts or reject to do any bank transfer as soon as the recipient or a sender is identified as being Zimbabwean, as a national, or being registered in Zimbabwe when we speak about companies. The same refers to the situations of companies which reject to trade directly with Zimbabwean companies as well as Zimbabwean individuals. There are several statements when, for example, some Zimbabwean scholars have reported that they suddenly became ineligible for a number of research projects they used to be eligible for.
Zimbabwean president has expressed hope that dialogue with the European Union will remain constructive and proceed in the spirit of equal partnership, while Britain and the United States have maintained an intransigent position towards Zimbabwe. President Mnangagwa is optimistic on the removal of these illegal sanctions following the recommendation by the UN Special Envoy.
We remain optimistic that their findings and recommendations will facilitate a positive outcome and bring relief to the people of Zimbabwe from the debilitating and justified coercive measures and illegal sanctions.
Now, do you see the sanctions being lifted anytime soon, and what needs to be done to see that happening?
I need to see that there is already some positive developments as concerns the application of sanctions against Zimbabwe. In particular, as I have already mentioned, the European Union and Switzerland have minimized the list of active cases of sanctions up to zero. And as I see, there is an attempt to enhance cooperation as well as enhance the level of investments to Zimbabwe and to restore the cooperation possibilities. I hope that the same track will be chosen by other sanctioning states, including the United States. I need to say that I had a very productive meetings with the diplomatic community in Zimbabwe, and the content of these discussions basically gives me some hope that the situation will improve. Naturally, I hope very much that the relations between the sanctioning states and Zimbabwe will develop on the base of the rule of law and on the base of the humanitarian assessment of any unilateral measures taken. That's why I believe in this sphere we can hope for the better development.
The sanctions on Zimbabwe were imposed when the country embarked on land reforms. We saw thousands of white commercial farmers vacating land they occupied during the colonial era. This land was given to landless black Zimbabweans who are the original owners of the land. For Western imperialist countries, this move was contrary to what they claim is the rule of law.
Now, our last question to you. We see the sanctioning states talking a lot about the rule of law and rules-based international order. What kind of law would allow violating of the people's basic rights, as we see in the case of these unilateral sanctions?
That's a very complicated question. Unfortunately, the world community didn't face much of unilateral sanctions before. And today what we are facing is basically the use of various sorts of terminology which doesn't look to be very precise from the point of the legality. I believe that it's necessary to look at that problem from the different perspective. We have a problem. We have a huge political discrepancy as concern the approach to this problem, and people's lives are affected because of the application of unilateral sanctions. And now it's necessary to use the rule of law and the general agreement about the need to promote and protect human rights to be able to bring international relations in this sphere back to normal.
Well, thanks a lot, Alina Dohan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Unilateral Coercive Measures. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall see how U.S.-based multinationals dominating the global chocolate industry are supporting modern-day slavery in West African cocoa farms. Don't go away.
Child labor in cocoa farms.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
According to some statistics, at least 1.56 million children, many as young as five, are working as slaves and child laborers harvesting cocoa for chocolate in Ivory Coast and Ghana.
Those two West African countries together supply nearly 70% of the world's cocoa beans, the raw ingredient for chocolate bars made by US-based multinationals such as Hershey, Mars, Cargill, and Nestle. One of the affected boys who managed to escape in Ivory Coast says he worked as a slave in the country's cocoa plantations.
To discuss the use of children as slaves and laborers in West African cocoa plantations, my colleague contacted Anthony Fountain, the managing director of the Voice Network, a watchdog and catalyst for reformed cocoa sector. Mr. Fountain started by expressing his opinion on how chocolate companies in the world are part of modern-day slavery in West African cocoa farms.
There's a lot of conversation around slavery in the chocolate sector. I think that numerically speaking, that's closer to about 10, 13,000 children that are probably being forced into child labor. The bigger problem in numbers is what we call the worst forms of child labor, where we see more than a million children working under the worst forms of child labor, which is dangerous child labor, on the cocoa farms in Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana. That's different than slavery, but it's still shocking and it really needs to be addressed.
The current use of child slaves and laborers in cocoa farms is the legacy of the evil era of colonial rule. Unfortunately, 6 decades after independence, Western multinationals are still looting and plundering Africa's resources while poverty lingers across the continent. Poverty is a vicious cycle in these cocoa-producing countries as kids, just like their parents, are forced to work in plantations due to grinding poverty.
I stopped going to school when I was 10 years old. When my parents didn't have enough money, I went out and helped them by working in the field.
Now, the issue of slavery and child labor in cocoa plantations has been discussed for decades, but there is no solution in sight. Can you say that capitalism motivated by greed is the source of this economic crime?
The reason why this problem remains the way it is because for the large chocolate companies, this system works very well. For the farmers and for their children and for the nature around them, it doesn't work very well. And I think that it's possible to have a sustainable supply chain, but for that to happen, there need to be consequences for economic and environmental and human rights violations. And currently, there aren't any consequences for it. As I sometimes like to call it, the reason we haven't solved the problems yet is we didn't have to. There are simply no consequences for the multinationals for when they destroy the planet and the people that are actually growing their cocoa. And until there will be consequences, until they are made to change, they won't change.
Now, following global outcry about child slavery, Western multinationals in the chocolate industry took a different approach.
They teamed up with various stakeholders to create the Harkin-Engel Protocol, which effectively quelled the 2000-2001 campaign. But they had no intention of stopping this evil exploitation of African children, as it would greatly reduce their profits. The cocoa industry ratified the Harkin-Engel Protocol and committed to reduce the most hazardous forms of child labor by 70% by 2020. Yet, top cocoa-producing countries are still grappling with child labor and slavery. Now, the question is, was the ratification of this protocol a mere public relations gimmick?
I think that when the Harkin-Engel, first the protocol and then later the Harkin-Engel framework, as it was later called, when that got started, it was really a means for the chocolate companies to avoid bad publicity and to avoid regulatory developments. They made a promise so that they wouldn't get a law. I think it's, you can put it as simple as that. Over the years, I think people working for the companies have really wanted to solve the problem, but so far we haven't seen any serious impact. We haven't seen any serious results yet in dealing with the concept of child labor in cocoa.
6 young boys between the ages of 12 and 14 from the impoverished African nation of Mali were taken from their homes and enslaved on Ivory Coast cocoa plantations. After their stories became known, in 2005, international human rights lawyers sued Nestle USA and Cargill, which profited from the forced labor.
The case was brought before the U.S. Supreme Court, and as expected, in June this year, the court issued a verdict in favor of these U.S.-based multinationals. We asked Mr. Fountain to give us his take on the verdict by the American court.
I am not an American lawyer or judge, so I'm not quite sure how far I can go to make a valid statement on that. But it's my impression that we need better laws before we can actually get justice. I think we really need to make sure that the laws that we have in place, that they are finally going to be good enough, that the laws say to companies, to multinationals, you are not allowed to profit off the back of child labor, deforestation, and extreme poverty. And as long as the law allows that kind of exploitation to happen, I'm not very hopeful that lawsuits will be very effective.
In Ghana, 59% of children in cocoa-growing households were in child labor and 55% in hazardous child labor in 2018 and 2019. The government there is engaged in plans to rectify the situation, as this labor official explains.
Government works through community partners because child labor is in the communities. It works with the chiefs, it works with opinion leaders, it works with the district assemblies, the children themselves, and is able to create partnership with them, saying that the community owns the problems themselves and are able to address it.
Now, governments in cocoa-producing countries have clearly failed to take enough action aimed at ending exploitation of their citizens by these multinationals in the cocoa industry. Can we hope that the situation will change for the better in future?
We're starting to see quite some hopeful movements there. The Ivorian and Ghanaian governments over the last 2 years have started to work together to try, for example, to drive up the prices for cocoa, because poverty is one of the key drivers to all of the problems that we have in the cocoa supply chain, whether it's child labor, gender inequality, deforestation. All of it is driven by poverty. And we're seeing the Ivorian and Ghanaian governments work together quite strongly to move the prices up, to start addressing these issues. But changing problems that are as deep and as fundamental as this will not happen overnight. And so I think we need to have to be patient, we have to be persistent, and we also have to continuously be looking at how can we do better than we are doing now. But the governments are starting to work on it, and they have a very important role to play, and there's a long way to go also there.
Well, that's the dark side of the chocolate industry. So every time you enjoy that chocolate bar, remember that child slavery might have been involved in the production process. Do your part and stop modern-day slavery perpetrated by greedy chocolate producers, mostly based in the United States. And on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's show. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.